This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. The White House is trying to explain what U.S. President Joe Biden meant last week when he said that the world now at a higher risk is now at a higher risk of nuclear Armageddon than at any other time since the Cuban Missile Crisis. VOA's Marissa Melton reports.
Belling disconnected the facility from the grid and forced it. A spokesman for the White House National Security Council told ABC's This Week program that the stakes are very high now as regards Russia's threats to use nuclear weapons in Ukraine. But John Kirby said despite stark language from the U.S. president at a Democratic fundraiser on Thursday, the president's words did not portend an immediate threat. Kirby did say the U.S. is keeping a close eye on the situation.
We just simply haven't seen an indication that Mr. Putin has either made a decision to use nuclear weapons in Ukraine or has done anything to get closer to that decision-making process.
Kirby said the United States will not be intimidated by threats of nuclear action. He also said the United States hopes to see the war end with the two sides coming together for negotiations. Marissa Melton, VOA News.
Meanwhile, the UN nuclear watchdog says an external power line to Ukraine's Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, the biggest in Europe, has been repaired after shelling disconnected the facility from the grid and forced it to resort to emergency diesel generators. The International Atomic Energy Agency said that the 750 kilovolt line was reconnected to the plant on Sunday evening following repair work by Ukrainian engineers that enabled the plant to start switching off the generators that had kicked it to provide it with power after the line, its last connection to the grid, was cut early Saturday. More at VOAnews.com. This is VOA News. Russian President Vladimir Putin is calling the attack on the bridge to Crimea a terrorist act carried out by the Ukrainian special services. In a meeting Sunday night with the chairman of Russia's investigative committee, Putin said that there's no doubt it was a terrorist act directed at the destruction of critically important civilian infrastructure. His investigative chief said he had opened a criminal case into an act of terrorism. Ukrainian officials, meanwhile, say a Russian missile strike on a southern city killed at least 13 people and partially collapsed an apartment building in the city of Zaporizhia. South Korea says North Korea has fired two ballistic missiles toward the eastern waters again. And the latest in a barrage of weapons tests in recent days, South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff says the launches were conducted from its eastern coastal area early Sunday. The Japanese government also says it detected the suspected North Korean launches. The launches were the seventh round of weapons tests in 2 weeks, and it came hours after the U.S. and South Korea wrapped up a new round of naval drills off the Korean Peninsula's east coast. U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres has submitted a letter to the Security Council proposing the immediate activation of a rapid action force after a plea for help from Haiti as gangs and protesters paralyze the country. The letter, which was seen by the Associated Press, has not been made public. It proposes the immediate activation of the rapid action force deployed by one or several member states to help Haiti's national police. That force would remove the threat posed by armed gangs and provide immediate protection to critical infrastructure as well as services. At least 22 people have died, 52 have disappeared after five small rivers in central Venezuela flooded due to heavy rains. The downpour swept large tree trunks and debris from surrounding mountains into the community about 40 south miles southwest of Caracas, damaging businesses and farmland. The vice president said the priority was to locate people still trapped under mud and rocks throughout the town, while military and rescue personnel also searched the riverbanks for survivors. Recapping our top story, the White House is trying to explain what U.S. President Joe Biden meant last week when he said that the world is now at a higher risk of nuclear Armageddon than at any time since the Cuban Missile Crisis. This is via remote account. Thank you.
Today's Monday, October 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, the U.S. vows to continue weapons supplies to Ukraine as Kyiv continues its counteroffensive against retreating Russian forces.
Quite frankly, we're in touch almost daily with the Ukrainians, and we're going to continue to provide them security assistance. You just saw the president approve another more than $600 million just a few days ago of additional HIMARS.
Alarm bells ring as North Korea fires the seventh missile in 2 weeks towards Japan.
Seoul warned that Pyongyang's consecutive provocations will deepen its international isolation and impact its already faltering economy.
And a human rights group reports at least 185 people, including children, killed in Iranian unrest. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. The White House said on Sunday it will continue to arm Ukraine but declined direct comment on an explosion that damaged Russia's road and rail bridge to Crimea. John Kirby, the National Security Council's Strategic Communications Coordinator, said both sides need to find a way to negotiate an end to the war, but that Russian President Vladimir Putin had shown no interest in doing so. Kirby said the United States had no indication that Putin has made any decision to use nuclear weapons and that there was no reason to change the strategic posture of the U.S.
The president was reflecting the very high stakes that they're in play right now. When you have modern nuclear power and the leader of that modern nuclear power willing to use irresponsible rhetoric the way that Mr. Putin has several times in just the last week or two, we are monitoring this as best we can. And we have been monitoring his nuclear capabilities, frankly, since he invaded Ukraine again back in February. So we're monitoring this very, very closely. And what I can tell you is that through all that process, we just simply haven't seen an indication that Mr. Putin has either made a decision to use nuclear weapons in Ukraine or has done anything to get closer to that decision-making process. So we're watching it as best we can. Again, the best thing I could tell you is that we haven't done anything to change our own strategic nuclear posture, and that's really about as far as we can go. We're watching this very, very closely. The president was talking about finding a way to end this war, which we all want to do. We all want to see this war end. It's gone on way too long. And what needs to happen is for the two sides to be able to sit down and negotiate and find a way out of this peacefully and diplomatically. Now, Mr. Putin has shown no indication, zero, none, that he's willing to do that. In fact, quite the contrary, by calling up hundreds of thousands of reservists, by politically annexing, or at least trying to annex, four areas of Ukraine, he's shown every indication that he's doubling down, that he wants to continue to prosecute this war, which is why, quite frankly, we're in touch almost daily with the Ukrainians, and we're going to continue to provide them security assistance. You just saw the president approve another more than $600 million just a few days ago of additional HIMARS and howitzers and other ammunition and some vehicles, tactical vehicles. You're going to see us continue to do that going forward.
That's John Kirby, the U.S. National Security Council's Strategic Communications Coordinator. Kremlin leader Vladimir Putin said on Sunday that the explosion on a key bridge linking Crimea and the Russian mainland was a terrorist act planned by the Ukrainian Special Services. Putin was meeting with Alexander Bashkin, the head of Russia's investigative committee, who was presenting findings of an inquiry into Saturday's explosion and fire on the bridge. As Ukrainian forces try to push their counteroffensive further into Russian-occupied territories, they may face tougher conditions on the battlefield. David Asher is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and a former U.S. State Department advisor with expertise in security issues. This is what Asher told Flashpoint Ukraine's Michael Lipin about how Ukrainian troops will soon need to shift their tactics.
The terrain, the further they get in, there's the road system's a little more advanced, as I understand it, and they're going to have to start thinking about urban warfare. Obviously, they've gone through Kharkiv City in part, but they've got more around it to take. And as they start to do this, they're going to start to get into more of an urban combat situation, which is hard to know how easy that will be to prosecute, but it'll be easier once they're in the area where there's roads than where they are sort of caught up in swampland or stuff that, because of the rain season, it's already begun. You're starting to get pretty difficult terrain, according to all the videos that I've been watching, of vehicles being abandoned by the Russians, but also just trouble with the Ukrainians trying to advance through mud. But I think that they're determined to get into some of the more urban terrain, trying to push all the way into Luhansk itself. And obviously, they're at sort of the doorfront to Donetsk. And then, of course, they're making this progress, which is really surprising, frankly, down in Kherson, where they've defended Mykolaiv and saved Odessa, and they're closing in on Kherson itself. I mean, it's almost like the Russian line is basically collapsing. And, you know, you see these images of the Russians giving up their T-80 battle tanks. I mean, these are the top line equipment. It's not the type of stuff that you'd expect people to give up without a fight. But there must be a significant morale issue that is traversing the entire Russian front in the areas that they just declared to be Russian territory through the sham referendum.
The Ukrainians have obviously been benefiting a lot from Western military aid. The U.S. announced more military assistance. What is your assessment of the effectiveness and the speed with which this aid is being given to Ukraine?
The effectiveness is high, but the speed of the aid is insufficient. We've sort of set out a red line internally that we wouldn't try to provoke what Biden termed World War III over the Ukraine. I understand that. But the sort of creeping support to give Ukraine the ability offensively to take back territory, I think we shouldn't just let it come out slowly or in pieces. I mean, it is increasing every week, it seems. But they've just given 4 new HIMARS missile systems, which is very important. I think they're about 20 now. But if we were going to do it, we should just give them 20 or 24 to begin with. And I'd give them the longer range missiles to go with it so that we could hit the Russian supply lines and lines of communication from the traditional Russian border into occupied eastern Ukraine. Putin might be provoked by it. He can use his nuclear weapons. He's going to use these things. He'll use them anyway, in my mind. We should provide the tools to the Ukrainians to win back their entire country, including what was lost in 2014, if you ask me.
Why do you think the Biden administration has not provided those stronger weapons to Ukraine faster?
I think it's their assessment that Putin would be willing to counter with unconventional means, most specifically nuclear. For him to do that, that's a dangerous path as well. It's sort of, he could be sealing his own fate, and he knows it because we could retaliate very swiftly. And I think we have plans to do that. The Russian Navy and the Black Sea could be basically erased if they use a nuclear weapon. That'd be one of the response options I'd recommend. But so to me, we should set out a goal of Ukraine capturing its territory, even going back to 2014, recapturing all of it. And at that level, I think there'll be a time to negotiate. But that's basically something that Putin, he probably won't accept that. There are some people in Russia, though, that are now even contemplating that. I've heard from some Russian former officials that there is a negotiation that the Russians might be willing to do to keep at least a piece of what they gained in 2014 or keep all of it in exchange for stopping the fight.
That's David Asher, a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and a former U.S. State Department advisor with expertise in security issues. He was speaking with Michael Lippin of Flashpoint Ukraine. South Korea says North Korea has fired 2 ballistic missiles towards its eastern waters, the latest in a barrage of weapon tests in recent days. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff says the launches were conducted from its eastern coastal area early Sunday. The Japanese government also says it detected the suspected North Korean launches. They were the North's 7th round of weapons tests in 2 weeks and come hours after the U.S. and South Korea wrapped a new round of naval drills off the Korean Peninsula's east coast. Associated Press correspondent Karine Chamas reports on Korean tensions.
The weapons test was one of many in recent weeks. Japan's Vice Defense Minister Toshiro Ino strongly condemned the move. North Korea's series of actions threaten the peace and stability of Japan, as well as the region and the international community, and is absolutely unacceptable. South Korea's presidential spokesperson Kim Un-hye emphasized the importance of outside support. We will continue our efforts to protect our people through trilateral security cooperation between South Korea, the U.S. and Japan. Seoul warned that Pyongyang's consecutive provocations will deepen its international isolation and impact its already faltering economy. I'm Karen Chamas.
China's foreign ministry said on Sunday the United States should create conditions to resume a dialogue with North Korea after Pyongyang fired 2 more ballistic missiles earlier in the day. On the previous day, Seoul scrambled fighter jets in reaction to an apparent North Korean bombing drill. The United States also announced new sanctions on Friday in response to Pyongyang's missile launches. North Korea's neighbor and ally, China, pointed to joint military exercises held by the United States and its allies around the Korean Peninsula when asked about Sunday's launches. U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken ended his week-long tour of South America talking about drugs and climate change at the Organization of American States in Lima, Peru. But it was immigration that dominated regional talks. For VOA News, Jamie Moreno accompanied the diplomat and has the story.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with Latin America leaders during the 52nd General Assembly of the Organization of American States in Lima and committed new humanitarian aid to migrants and refugees.
We have more people on the move around the world, displaced from their homes, than at any time in recorded history, more than 100 million.
Before arriving in Peru, Blinken met with Chile's President Gabriel Boric at the government palace. The two discussed migration and the commercial relationship between the two countries. Blinken also held a meeting with Chile's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Antonia Urrejola. Among the topics was the Venezuelan migration crisis, which, according to the United Nations Refugee Agency, exceeds 6 million people. The two also pledged to work to facilitate talks between rival political factions in Venezuela.
The talks can be resumed with Maduro's government and the Venezuelan opposition. What we want as a country, and on this we are aligned with the United States, other countries in the region, and European countries, is for these talks to be resumed so that Venezuela can have free and democratic elections in 2024.
During his visit to Colombia, Blinken visited Bogota's Migratory Integration Center to learn about the Colombian capital's strategy to deal with ongoing migration issues. Since 2017, the USA has sent nearly $3 billion in aid to Colombia and neighboring countries to help them deal with the millions of displaced Venezuelans. The migration centers created at the end of August allow Venezuelan migrants to request and access services.
Bueno, estoy haciendo el trámite de permiso de permanencia aquí en
I think it's a really good option because you can access work without any type of issues. You can have more options to work in any area that you
want.
All three countries Blinken visited, Colombia, Chile, and Peru, recently elect leftist leaders. That's a significant regional shift to the left that has been happening since 2018 and could see the Latin America's six largest economies led by the left-leaning leaders by the end of the year. Jaime Moreno, VOA News, Lima, Peru.
Protests ignited by the death of a young woman in police custody continued across Iran on Sunday, despite a fierce crackdown by the authorities. And as a human rights group said, at least 185 people, including children, had been killed in the unrest. Rachel Graham of Reuters reports.
At least 185 people have been killed amid unrest in Iran, a human rights group said, following the death of a young woman in police custody, which has sparked protests across the country. 19 children are among the dead, Norway-based Iran Human Rights Group reported. The protests have become the biggest challenges to Iran's clerical leaders in years, with demonstrators calling for the downfall of Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Despite the fierce crackdown by authorities, protesters remain undeterred. In Javanlud, video obtained by Reuters and released on Saturday showed fires burning on a road. Reuters was not able to confirm the date it was filmed. Videos on social media showed female students chanting "Get Lost" as Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi visited their university campus on Saturday. Reuters was able to confirm the video's location based on satellite imagery, but not the date it was captured. Authorities have described the protests as a plot by Iran's foes, including the United States. They have also denied accusations that live bullets have been used. Other demonstrations in solidarity with the women of Iran have taken place around the world. On Saturday, protesters gathered in London to show their support. The unrest was sparked after Mahsa Amini died in police custody. The 22-year-old had been arrested in Tehran for wearing inappropriate attire.
That's Rachel Graham of Reuters. In other news, authorities say a landslide fueled by flooding and days of torrential rain has swept through a town in central Venezuela, leaving at least 22 people dead as it dragged mud, rocks and trees through neighborhoods. Dozens of people are missing. Residents of Las Tajeras in Santo Michelina, an agro-industrial town in Aragua State, 57 miles southwest of Caracas, had just seconds to reach safety late Saturday as debris swept down a mountainside onto them. The official death rose to 22 after the recovery of 20 bodies on Sunday, Vice President Delcy Rodriguez told state-owned Venezuela de Televisión on Sunday. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chino Dolfo in Washington. The United Nations reports a little progress had been made in efforts to reform the Philippine anti-drug policy, which has claimed the lives of thousands of people and bring justice to the victims of human rights violations and abuses. The Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights has submitted its latest report to the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN Human Rights Office signed a technical cooperation agreement in 2020 with the Philippines in hopes of blunting the brutal impact of the government's anti-drug operations. Unfortunately, the stated aim of protecting and promoting human rights in the country has largely failed. Acting High Commissioner for Human Rights Nada Al-Nashif says the Philippines government has taken some steps to pursue accountability for human rights violations and abuses. However, she notes access to justice remains elusive for victims.
Victims' willingness to engage was also hampered by inadequate support and protection and fear of reprisals. While official figures reflect a decrease in killings in the context of anti-drug operations, the office continues to receive allegations of unlawful killings and other human rights violations by members of the Philippine National Police.
Human rights organizations claim more than 20,000 people have been killed since Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte took office in 2016 and carried out his war on drugs. Human Rights Watch says at least 2,555 of the killings were carried out by the Philippine National Police. Al-Nashif notes an interagency panel was established to review 5,655 anti-drug operations during which deaths occurred. But she says none of the cases investigated by the panel has resulted in convictions.
Numerous victims and their families still await justice. So in the time remaining in the joint program, together with other efforts, concrete progress on accountability is expected to help bring about human rights reforms that will prevent the recurrence of further violations.
Al-Nashif says she welcomes the commitment of the new administration following the May election to the implementation of the joint program, which is now at its midpoint. In response, Secretary of Justice of the Philippines, Jesus Crispin Remula, assured the acting High Commissioner that his government was undertaking transformational reforms of its justice and law enforcement sectors. He said the new president is tackling illegal drugs by focusing on apprehending and punishing the criminal masterminds, not small-scale users on the street. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. Australian academics say a project to grow plants on the moon could help feed communities on Earth that suffer from climate-driven weather disasters. The researchers are supporting an ambitious mission that aims to grow plants on the lunar surface by as early as 2025. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
The project is led by an Australian space startup called Lunaria One. It will be the first in a series of experiments to investigate whether plants can not only tolerate the harsh lunar surface, but thrive. Academics from several Australian universities, along with colleagues in Israel, South Africa and the United States, have said it's an early step toward growing plants for food, medicine and oxygen production, which are crucial to establishing human habitation on the moon. There could also be benefits back on Earth. Researchers hope the moon mission will help reveal new ways to improve food production in harsh climates on Earth, or after natural disasters, when food supplies are often scarce. Australian National University Associate Professor Caitlin Burt is a science advisor for Lunaria One. She told VOA that research in space can help solve problems on Earth.
A spin-off from being able to solve this engineering feat is that if you can create a unit that can grow plants in the sort of extremes of space, then that also helps inform us to what we could create here on Earth to be able to address things like food security challenges. So you can imagine that after you have like a natural disaster and populations trying to recover, being able to have systems where you can rapidly propagate plants in protected environments would be a great asset.
One of the plants being considered for the mission is an Australian native called resurrection grass that can endure harsh conditions and survive in a dormant state for months without any water. It would be sent to the moon in a hermetically sealed chamber on board the Bereshit 2 spacecraft, a private Israeli moon mission. The plants would be grown in a small protected box and monitored. Australian academics have said they hope to begin their lunar experiment by 2025. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This has been International Edition under Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com and check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition and our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedofo in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In response to the tragic and brutal death of a young Iranian woman, Mahsa Amini, as well as the violent suppression of peaceful protests, Secretary of State Antony Blinken has announced sanctions against Iran's so-called morality police and senior security officials. 22-year-old Mahsa Amini was arrested in Tehran for purportedly wearing a hijab too loosely. She died while in custody of Iran's so-called morality police. Street patrols by the morality police in Iran intensified this summer. President Ibrahim Raisi had called for strict enforcement of laws imposed after the revolution in 1979 that obliged women to cover their hair and wear long, loose-fitting clothes. Protests throughout Iran erupted after Amini's death. They have been met with force by the authorities. The Iranian government's crackdown is ongoing. Authorities have reportedly killed dozens of protesters, and last week the Iranian government cut off access to the internet for most of the 80 million citizens to prevent them and the rest of the world from watching its ongoing violent crackdown on peaceful protesters. In a separate statement, the Treasury Department said the officials designated by the Office of Foreign Assets Control oversee organizations that routinely employ violence to suppress peaceful protests and members of Iran's civil society, political dissidents, women's rights activists, and members of the Baha'i community. The seven designated officials include Iran's Minister of Intelligence and Security, the head of Iran's Morality Police, and the head of its Tehran division. The sanctions also target the deputy commander of the Basij, the deputy commander of Iran's Law Enforcement Forces, the LEF, the LEF commander of Chahar Mahal and Bakhtiari province, and the commander of the Iranian Army's ground forces. These men have been involved in serious rights abuses, including violence against detainees and the use of deadly force against protesters. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen called the death of Mahsa Amini another act of brutality by the Iranian regime's security forces against its own people. She added, "We condemn this unconscionable act in the strongest terms and call on the Iranian government to end its violence against women and its ongoing violent crackdown on free expression and assembly." Today's actions, Secretary Yellen declared, demonstrates the Biden-Harris administration's clear commitment to stand up for human rights and the rights of women in Iran and globally.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.